Welcome to the Barth Calderon Wealth Protector Podcast. Our founder, Harry Barth, and his son, Brad, are top speakers on asset protection and estate planning to many incredible groups across the country, including the Women Presidents Organization, Vistage, the Young Presidents Organization, the California Apartment Association, and many more. And now, here is your host, Paul Hitchcock.
Thank you, everybody, for being here. Really excited for this topic. It's a hot one, and have two great people on the episode. Brant Houston, who is a Vistage chair out of Houston. And welcome, Brant.
Hey, it's good to be here, Paul.
Yeah, and then I have Harry Barth, who is the founder and senior managing partner of an asset protection, estate planning, and business planning law firm in California called Barth Calderon, and he's my colleague at Barth Calderon and my boss. Hello, Harry. Welcome.
Hi, Paul. How are you?
Yeah. So we're going to get started here. Obviously, a very hot topic, the Corporate Transparency Act. And Brant, I want to start with you and just give us a little background on you and what you're doing there with Vistage and what you're building. Obviously, you and I have talked a lot offline. You're doing a lot of great stuff, but I'd love to hear from you, and then we'll get into what Harry's doing around the CTA.
Yes, well, I have a Vistage CEO group on the north side of Houston. So we go from, if you're familiar with the geography, you could put a stake at the Woodlands and draw a radius around that. But we have 17 members. We get together once a month, have a, you know, it's a really productive time. We finished a meeting yesterday. Several members said it was the best one we've had in recent years. And when it comes down to, and so what we do, I mean, we're helping each other with opportunities and problems they face, and they all share the same issues. You get right down to it. But when it comes to the Corporate Transparency Act, I would say they have heard of it, but nobody's that well versed in it. And least of all me, you know, I'm really looking forward to this session with Harry, because I'm the managing partner of 10 LLCs.
including you're going to love what I have to say.
Oh yeah. Three of them are disregarded entities. I'm a shareholder in a closely held S corporation of a family members that holds a farm inherited from our grandfather. And my wife and I have a living trust. I'm a limited partner in a number of partnerships and a member of LLCs that own real estate. And I can't imagine how many entities among my 17 members are out there like this. Anyway, I'm really looking forward to what we're going to learn today.
Yeah, and Brant, you have some spots open for your group. Who are you looking for?
Well, we're just looking for, actually, we're getting close to a waiting list now, but we're looking for decision makers in small to mid-sized companies, 10 million up to 200-300 million in revenue is where our sweet spot is.
Yep.
And so as long as it's a decision maker that's a owner, CEO, or even whether it's a hired CEO or founder, most of our members are founders or maybe second generation, but if they're fit that category of north side of Houston, love to talk with them.
Great. Okay. Well, I just want to say before we get to Harry, I'm going to put a couple things in chat here. I'll put Brant's email address in there, so you have a way to get a hold of Brant. And also, as you have questions here about this new law as it pertains to you, we are offering a chance for you to get one-on-one with Harry and the team. It's complimentary to answer your questions as a follow-up. So there's a link I'll put in there. If you click on that, it gets you over to us. Happy to give back as you're taking the time to find out what we're talking about. Okay, Harry, let's get into this.
Okay, we have a lot to talk about today. This is a very, very, very interesting and distressing topic at the same time. So I'm going to take you through it, and I'm pretty sure that by the end of our hour together, you'll have a great understanding of what this is all about. And, you know, there's a lot of hoopla about the Corporate Transparency Act, and what's seemingly simple is not, as any typical government thing is. First, some definitions. FinCEN. You're going to hear the word FinCEN coming out of my mouth a lot. That's the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, and it is a division of the United States Department of Treasury. This is the same people that monitor offshore bank accounts. Their role primarily is to get behind shell and shelf companies for financing terrorism, tax evasion, financial crimes. And what the Corporate Transparency Act is, it's very important for us to understand philosophically what it's all about, because it'll help us in the implementation and the specifics of the act. The key for all of this is the government is building a registry for government use only, not public use, government use only, government, international governments, but government and law enforcement use. Who are the humans, the human beings behind the walls of the company? So I think that's really important. If we can't drill down to who the human being is, we're not going to be in compliance with the Corporate Transparency Act. Kind of this whole philosophy started after 9/11 with the financing of terrorism. We've had the Patriot Act. And we have, the government's been trying to do this for a long time. They passed this bipartisan legislation in 2021. They delayed it for 2022. They delayed it for 2023. But launchpad, here we are in 2024. And the Corporate Transparency Act is active. Now, a couple things in the background of this that we need to know that are critically important. First, there is a case by the National Small Business Association in federal court in Alabama that is moving through the federal judicial system, with the hopes, the end result of that, is to have the Corporate Transparency Act declared unconstitutional. So let me give you my 45-year learned legal opinion on where I think that's going to go. I think eventually some parts of the Corporate Transparency Act may be declared invalid, but in general, I think it's going to be upheld. Why? One, it's bipartisan politically. Two, most of the modern Western economies, France, Britain, Germany, Denmark, Spain, all of those, and most of the modern Asian economies already have this type of disclosure in effect in the government. So this is nothing new for them. It's new for us. Two, you'll find that since 9/11 and the evolution of FinCEN, Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, we've had Know Your Client rules. I'm sure, Brent, you have client, people, members in the venture capital business, loans, banking. Believe me, in banking today, you're not going to get a loan if we don't know the inside of the size of your underwear. We want to see your driver's licenses, your passports. We want backgrounds, records. We want to know who we're lending to. We need to know our client to avoid money laundering and all the other issues. So this falls squarely within that. So I also think it's not going to remain unconstitutional. And the other aspect of that is that even a simple notary requires address and driver's license and identifying stuff. So this is not crazed. Now, it's important to understand that the registry that they're building, which includes every single entity that's not exempt, that is ever in existence in the United States of America, that's about 33 million, and every new entity be formed in the United States of America to comply with this act. It's enormous in that respect. And so we have some other components of this which are interesting. So as we go through today, you're going to see different deadlines that are involved, but there is some changes. So there is a bill that has been passed by the House, not yet passed in the Senate, which may modify it, and not yet signed by Joe, good old Joe. But what'll happen is that some of the deadlines that we'll be talking about today, I'll talk about when we get into the specifics of the act, may be extended. It's just, I don't know how we're going to register 33 million companies, in 12 months. And two, an aspect of it, which is a little draconian, which I will respect. This is the new legislation modifying the now existing Corporate Transparency Act. So let's start with, as we begin to drill down into this, who has to comply? If you are a corporation, limited liability company, just count the brand. If you are an LLC or any other entity that is created by a filing with the Secretary of State, is we all know it to be a legal person. So if a legal person has been created, a corporation, LLC, limited partnership, LLP, LLLP, whatever it may be, if we got to go to the Secretary of State and get articles to set us up, we are subject to the Corporate Transparency Act. And I'm going to today do a dividing line where we'll talk about a new entity being formed in 2024 versus all of the existing entities that are in existence prior to 2024. But this is, in general, all of the companies that are subject to this act. And when we're subject to the act, so we give birth to, we file for a new company January, you know, tomorrow, January 20th, we have from the date that the state of Texas says you are effective as an LLC in the state of Texas on January 20th, we now have 90 days to bring that entity into compliance. So the next question is, before we talk about the exemptions to it, are they serious about this? Oh my God. So here's the deal. Once we are supposed to be in compliance, if we are not, we are subject, and I say we will learn who we is, to a $500 a day fine, all right, for up to 30 days, not insignificant, a $10,000 criminal fine on top of that, and up to 2 years of imprisonment. It is a felony not to comply with this act. And the difficulties in complying with it make it interesting. Because of that, and you'll learn, I think it's really important, whether it be us or any other law firm, a law firm that's highly specialized in, you know, asset protection, estate planning, business transactions, because that's why we have all these entities. It's for all of those reasons that we have them, and limiting liability, should be engaged to help analyze whether or not we're subject to the act and what we need to comply with. And then a filing service of some sort should file it, or you could sit online forever with a government website and try to do it yourself. I don't think it's a good idea. Plus, you lose attorney-client privilege. And when you're dealing with something that could ultimately become a criminal problem, I think attorney-client privilege is important. So, and as just a side note, the AICPA, the CPA organization, has basically told the CPAs, stay away from this. This is the unauthorized practice of law. Boot it to a law firm. All right. Other financial organizations, filing organizations, have said, boot it to a law firm. This whole structure really is a bird of a legal issue. Okay. That being said, in the background, and now we have some understanding of where it is, and understanding that we're looking for the humans behind the layers. Let's talk about who is not subject to this. All right. There are 23 exemptions. Let me give you most of them, and some of them that really are very, very particular to Vistage members. So first of all, public companies. If you're a public company filed on a stock exchange, NASDAQ, American Stock Exchange, New York Stock Exchange, public companies, there's such a high degree of regulation that's involved with that. They are not subject to this act. This act, Brant, is targeted for small businesses, the LLC that owns a piece of real estate, the limited partnership that owns stocks, bonds, and cash, all the things that we do, this is who it's targeted for, not the big companies. Certain entities that are registered investment advisors are exempt because they're regulated by the SEC and everybody knows who they are. Venture capitalists who are registered are not subject to this act. Insurance companies and insurance producers, you get the picture. They're regulated. We know who they are. They're licensed, not subject to the act. Certain highly regulated financial organizations, such as banks, credit unions, registered securities broker-dealers, are not subject to the act. Noticeably missing is trust companies, but I would say that trust companies are highly regulated and more likely not subject to the act. CPA firms, public accounting firms, if they are reporting under Sarbanes-Oxley, are probably not subject to the act. Nonprofits, guys, charities, political organizations are not subject to the act. Entities assisting tax-exempt entities are not subject to the act. Of course, the government itself is not subject to the act. And subsidiaries that are owned or controlled by an exempt company, if your company is exempt, Brent, and we look down and you have two or three subsidiaries to it. If the papa is exempt, the babies will be exempt as well. Now, there is one very important one, and when I give you this, everybody should take note that there is what they call the large operating company exemption. Now, these are not or, these are and, all right? Not or, and. So we must meet all three criteria to be exempt, all right, from filing. One, we have to have 20 or more full-time employees as defined by state law. So 37 and a half hours, 40 hours, you know, they need to be a full-time employee. We need to be based in the good old US of A in the United States of America, and we have to have gross sales of greater than $5 million. So if we have 20 employees, we have our headquarters in the good old US of A, and we have $5 million worth of gross sales, we are not a reporting company. But however, should we get down for whatever reason during recession to 15 employees, we're based in the United States of America and still have over 5 million of sales, we become a reporting company. So that's very important to understand. When we fall below, we become a reporting company. Now, how long do we have once we fall below? Under current law, changes need to be reported to FinCEN within 30 days. Under the new act that's moving through Congress, it extends that to 90 days. All right. So, but right now it's 30 days to report changes. Okay. Can't hear you, Brent. You're muted. Now you are still muted. Now you're unmuted.
So are we talking about new entities there?
No, we're talking about any entity.
Any
entity. Okay. You have an entity in the past that had 20 employees, now it became 19 as a reporting entity. All right.
Okay.
So now let's begin to dig in a little bit. And we have a reporting entity. I will kind of bring this in at the first part of our conversation with new entities being formed after January 1st, 2024. As I said earlier, once that entity is alive by the Secretary of State or tribal nation of Indians, whatever it may be, or foreign, and Nevis, Cook Island LLCs, offshore LLCs, offshore companies. Once they are active and they are not exempt, we have 90 days to comply with the FinCEN rules and the Corporate Transparency Act. So let's take a look at what it takes to be in compliance. Now, this is really interesting, so stay with me. There'll be a lot of white papers. We'll have a lot of follow-up questions, but it's important to understand. So we have a new company. We'll call it Harry Paul Brandt Co. LLC. It's a Texas LLC. And you know what it's going to do? It's going to manufacture widgets. Okay. We are a reporting company. We're under 20 employees. We're under $5 million of gross sales, but we're based over here in Texas. So as a reporting company, within 90 days, this is what the company must report to FinCEN. So this is the company reporting. And the company that's not exempt is the company that is responsible to make sure that all of the aspects of its reporting are reported to the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. So we need to report the legal name of the company as it was filed with the Secretary of State of Texas. We also need to report all of the fictitious business names that are used. So if it's Harry Paul Brandt Co. doing business as Widgets R Us, Widgets R Us needs to be reported as well. We then need to report the physical address of where we're making the widgets. Not the attorney's office, not the CPA's office, not a UPS post office box, not a post office box. Where are we located? We must tell them where we are located. And then we must send to FinCEN our unique identifying number for that entity, which is traditionally the EIN number, the employee identification number that we obtain from the IRS. So once we have to obtain that number, and we get it. Now, if we formed a disregarded entity, right, all right, that disregarded entity is also subject to the Corporate Transparency Act, and you might not have an EIN number for that entity. You could obtain one for convenience, or you must use your Social Security number as the taxpayer identifying number for that entity. So now we got a reporting entity. So that's the information on the entity itself. That's pretty straightforward. Now, once we have a reporting entity and it's done, we now have other things. So now the CTA requires another group of correspondence, which is called the company applicant. So let's say you used my firm to form this entity. So the paralegal in my firm that formed the entity for us must report. So she must put down her name, address, phone number, and her driver's license or passport. Let me pause here for a second. FinCEN under the CTA gives us an option that all of us should take advantage of. We can go, this law firms can't do for you, our filing service can't do for you. You have to do it yourself. You go on FinCEN's website, and Paul will put that in the chat in a little while, what that website is, and get a FinCEN identifying number. So, Brent, you go into the website, and you give them all your information, who you are, you know, any fictitious names that you've used, your home address, your passport, your driver's license. You send it all in, and they will then give you back a number. It's like your Social Security number, 3000-000-1234. Mm-hmm. Brant, that's your FinCEN identifying number. So whenever we need to use you as one of the required reporting, we just put your name and your number down. We don't have to put all that, your home address and upload your driver's license every single time. You have a identifying number that's associated with you. I can't get that for you because they have all those questions like, where did you go to elementary school? Who was your best friend? Two-factor authentication. So you got to get that, and then you would give it to the filing service. Go ahead, Brent, with your question.
So if I form a corporation or an LLC or whatever, I have to get that number.
Once you have it, you got it.
Yeah, okay.
It's for everything. You could form 100 after that using that and that number. One. It's like your Social Security. It's an identifying number. Now, the obligation that you have is to make sure that if any of that information changes, change of address, change driver's license, move from Texas to Oklahoma, whatever it may be, we got to go, you have 30 days in the time you do that to go back to FinCEN and update that information. So it'll still be the same name and number, but the information behind it has to change. If you're not in compliance, $500 a day.
And that site, I put that site in the chat, the FinCEN site. You can go there.
So back to where we are. So now we have Harry, Paul, Brant Co. LLC. The entity is filed. My corporate paralegal, Cheyenne, has identified as a company applicant. If I am the attorney that recommended that LLC to you, I must also say that I am the recommender. I'm the one that told Cheyenne how to do it on behalf of Harry, Paul, and Brant Co. So for all new entities formed after January 1st, 2024, those entities, unless they're exempt, have to give all the company information. And the people that put it together for you have to give their information as well.
Harry, James is asking, does every member of an LP need to obtain an identification number from FinCEN?
It's a good idea. It's optional if not every member has to submit that information over and over and over again. I got my number. It took about 30 minutes. I got my number. Okay.
So that's every member of an LP. Is that every limited partner in an LP?
I'm getting there. So now we have the company and the things that we have to send for the company. We have the formers of the company. We got that in there. Now let's look at the company itself. Every owner, beneficial owner, it's called a BOI, beneficial ownership interest. Every owner that owns over 25% of that LLC, Harry, Paul, Brant, third, we must give our information to FinCEN. Because, you know, Harry, Paul, Brant Co. is not the humans. Who are the humans that own it? Harry owns it, Paul owns it, Brant owns it. Now we need your address, and identification, driver's license, passport, or our number if we have our number. So in this particular case, all three of us need to do that. But it gets better, all right? Because
I can't wait.
Although, wait till we get there. Although that we say beneficial ownership interest, so we have three owners. It's a misnomer. It's also anyone who has control. So the manager of the LLC, which could be Joe Blow, we need his information. If it's managed by a corporation, all right? So you hired a manager, ABC Co. We need the president of ABC Co., all the C-suite members of ABC Co., the CFO, the CEO, and if ABC Co. has a board of directors that can remove and replace the C-suite executives, every member of the board of directors needs to comply as well. That's just for the management. So management and or control is reporting as well. So it's not just the ownership interest, but the others. Now, we look up, what do we do? Who holds his interest? So, Brant, you have your 33 and a third, and you want to put it in your trust, where it belongs, to avoid probate, asset protection purposes, privacy, whatever else may be. We all keep our assets in our trust. Some of them are irrevocable, some are asset protection trust, some are estate planning trust, all the stuff that we do. So now the beneficial owner is the trust. Now, trusts themselves are exempt from the Corporate Transparency Act. They're not filed with the state, at least not yet. But your trust is now a beneficial owner of your one-third. So who's in the trust? If the settlor, Brant, has the ability to remove and replace assets or substitute assets, the settlor becomes a reporting person. The trustee is a report, or trustees, community property state, husband or wife, both the two trustees, maybe you, are reporting persons. If we have a trust protector that's in there for flexibility with an irrevocable trust who can make changes to the trustee, they must report. If we have a trust company, the trust officers that have the ability to change or move assets, they must report. So you have us and people that hold something we use in the estate planning called power of appointment. I mean, we could change the direction in the trust. So Brant could say, look, I want to direct this on my death, through my will, away from my children, to a charity. You might have the ability to do that within the trust. It's called a power of appointment. Since you could change the direction, the person holding the power of appointment must report. If there's a voting trust, it must report. If there are convertible securities that convertible into equity and get a vote, and that vote is there, they must report. So what's happening is on that simple, seemingly simple LLC, we can have 30 or 40 reporting entities, and there is no exceptions. That's a very important part. So let's go to Texas for a second. And let's drill an oil well. Most oil wells in Texas, we've done them, we're an LLC. So that's a reporting entity for sure. The four owners that invested in that oil well, each one of them is an LLC. All four of them are reporting for the reporting entity of this oil well. Those four LLCs may be held by a holding company. It becomes a reporting entity, and that's in the trust, and that becomes their reporting entity. So it is not as simple as it might appear. As a matter of fact, in some cases, Brant, it's simple as hell. And in some cases, like I just described, it's complicated as hell.
Harry, you got questions about this very specific issue? Do you want to?
Sure. Let me just talk about one aspect of it first, then we'll grab a few questions.
And Brant, you can handle those questions
along the way.
Okay.
So what's important in the legislation? Remember, I said earlier that there's one draconian aspect of the revision legislation that's moving through Congress. In the revision legislation, it takes changes, guys, from 30 days to 90 days, which is good. And it gives us instead of we have to be in compliance for all 33 million by December 31st, 2024, it gives us a year to December 31st, 2025. So we get 2 years to more runway, which I think is very, very important. But it also has this draconian provision that's written in grammar that nobody can understand that basically tells FinCEN from Congress, Brant, you may have 35 of the 36 required people. You have all the information. 36 is a holdout. We don't even know who 36 may be. It's held by a trust that hasn't been looked at for 10 years. FinCEN is instructed not to even look at it until it's complete. So if you can't find out who 36 is, you got to buy them out. You got to excise them. You got to get rid of them. You got to just, they won't look at it because you're not going to be in compliance. So this is, I don't know if that's going to ever be constitutional or how it works or it doesn't, but that's what's in the new legislation. It's quite distressing actually, but it is what it is. So let's take a few questions here. So that's what it takes to get a new entity born, Brant. All right. And we haven't even looked at your 9 entities yet, or my 12 entities. All right. So yeah. We all have these, but oh, maybe just one more thing before we take questions. So one of the things too is that when we form new operating agreements or looking at existing operating agreements, limited partnership agreements, limited liability partnership agreements, or corporate shareholder agreements, they should now be modified with new language called Corporate Transparency Act and require people that are signing the shareholders agreement and or becoming members of the LLC to say that they, in order to be a member, not get kicked out, you know, for cause, mm-hmm. that they will supply the information needed to keep the company in compliance with the Corporate Transparency Act. Okay, go for it. Questions?
Yeah, I'm not seeing the questions, Paul. So
I'll handle that. Yeah, Q&A. So a couple here. If the attorney who helped you set up your LLC isn't practicing anymore, what do you do?
Well, there's two things. So the January 1st forward, the new entities have the requirement for the company applicant, which is the paralegal and the attorney, or whoever did it. Doesn't matter whoever, that'd be a lawyer, not a lawyer. For the companies, which I haven't talked about yet, that are in existence before January 1st, 2024, and that have to be in compliance by December 31st, 2024, the company applicant is not required.
Got it.
So we don't need to go backtrack who the hell did it 15 years ago.
Okay.
Okay. I'm caught up, Paul. And okay. I see a question here from one of my members, Luke Cheatham. I'm a licensed individual. I understand my RIA and other licensed entities along with their sub entities are exempt. If I own a separate management company for consolidated payroll, less than 20 people and less than $5 million in sales, is that company exempt because the owner?
Nope.
Okay. Done. Even though I am licensed.
Doesn't matter. It's not the individual, it's the company. Does the company have 20 or more employees? No. Does the company have $5 million of gross sales? Probably not. Okay, so that doesn't get us there. It's not one of the 23 exemptions that exist.
Okay.
That company must comply. Now, if it's a subsidiary of the exempt company, it's a subsidiary of the RIA, which usually it would not be. That would be really dumb. But assuming mm-hmm. it was a subsidiary, then the answer is no. If it's a standalone company, brothers, sister entities, compliance, parent-child entities, possibly exempt.
Okay, so further related to that, to PEOs, if you have a PEO with more than 20 people and you have more than $5 million in sales, are you exempt?
Yes.
Okay.
It's 20 employees, all right? Now, it's interesting, the PEO, of course, has employees on behalf of others, all right? And so you might have 1,000 employees that you're handling employer responsibilities for, but the PEO itself, the administrative organization, may only have 15 employees. So the question that's really being asked is, are the employees that you are taking care of for another company counted as employees? You know, but the gross sales are the gross sales, because that's the fees that are being paid to the PEO. I would say, although it's not specifically addressed in the act, that brings us back to the original purpose of the act. In that PEO, we want to know who the owner is. Otherwise, terrorists, money launderers, and others can own the PEO, all right, and carry on those duties, and they don't make it. So I would say the actual direct employees of the PEO need to be 20. The actual gross sales of the PEO needs to be 5 million. The fact that they're providing services for other employers under a PEO, because even under liability purposes, when we do asset protection, a PEO doesn't take away the employer-related liability for a PEO employee. So I would say, yeah, they need compliance. Remember, this is brand new. The water is moving around. So we have those that are black and white answers and those which are just based upon my almost half century of experience. Okay. Any more questions?
Caught up for now, I think.
Okay. So let's continue on a little bit. All right. So we talked about modifying shareholders' agreements and operating agreements and things like that. So one of the things that, you say, what could be a benefit? What are the benefits, Brent, for you, all your members, and for everybody else out there? It's a great time maybe to take inventory, stock and pause, and review. Make sure our operating agreements are up to speed. Make sure our shareholders' agreements are up to speed. Make sure our buy-sell agreements are still good and well. Make sure that, like even myself, my God, when I was going through my own stuff, I realized that two or three of my entities were not assigned to my trust. But see, it's my asset protection trust. They were just sitting out there, and I missed them over the years. Shoemaker's shoes. Yeah. So it's a great time to just take pause and take inventory. The other thing to recognize, too, is that this is one and done. All right. Once that entity, we have Harry, Paul, Brent Co., is filed, and all of the beneficial ownership and controlling interests are all reported, and we get the green light from FinCEN, that we're in compliance with CTA, we're done. There's nothing else we have to do. It's not an annual reporting requirement. We are registered. What we do need to do is handle changes. So, for example, the 25% is also an aggregate. So if you own 12.5%, Brent, your wife owns 12.5%, that's 25. If you own 12% and your kids own the other 12.5%, that's attributed, that's 25. If a minor owns 25%, they do not have to report. But the parents of the minor or the guardians have to report. When that minor reaches age 18, they have to report, and the parents no longer have to report. Someone dies, all right? Then it goes into probate or into a trust administration. At the conclusion, just to give us a break there, at the conclusion of the probate, at the conclusion of the trust administration, when the asset is actually transferred to the beneficiary, that beneficiary, if it's over 25%, needs to report. But we also have to be careful. So let's try this. So we each own 33, not 33 and a third. So we formed an LLC, Brent, that it has both voting and non-voting interests. Mm-hmm. Harry owns 33% non-voting. Paul owns 33% non-voting. Brent owns 33% non-voting. And Joe Blow owns 1% voting. Now, Joe Blow, okay, and we are a reporting company. Joe Blow doesn't qualify under the 25% ownership, 1% ownership. But his 1% ownership is equal to control. He becomes a reporting entity. And if he is another corporation, for that 1% controlling interest, we are subject to the CTA. The other thing we need to know is that many of us have shelf companies or companies that we formed over the years that we've kept up to speed, but don't do anything. I see them all day long. Mm-hmm. I mean, I see about 20 clients a week, and we look at the inventory and their assets, and, oh, yeah, I formed that company. We never did anything with it, but I've kept it. You know, I paid for it. I kept it. I paid a state fee for it. It's a reporting.
Yes, I do that because I may want to do something, and now I have it there.
But that's exactly what it's for. You can keep it, all right? but we need to report it. Okay. If we have benefit, if it's dissolved mm-hmm. before you report, we don't have to report it. But some people also, rather than doing a specific dissolution of the entity, kind of let them die a slow death on the vine. So the state just eventually suspends it. It's a reporting entity until it's suspended. So we have those things that we need to be aware of. Now, let's go to everything before January 1st, 2024. There's not much more to add here, but let me add what I think is necessary. So, first of all, I have no idea on the planet how we're going to register 33 million companies in less than 12 months. I just don't know how it's going to be done. So hopefully the legislation that's weaving its way through will pass, which will give us an extra year. And hopefully that draconian section of they won't even look at it unless it's complete might get exercised by the Senate. We'll see. But anyway, for every company that we own that's non-exempt, you have 9, I have 12, they're all reporting entities. So what should we do? Well, first of all, I strongly suggest that all of us get a FinCEN identifying number. You don't have to, but think about it. Do you want to give everyone your home address and your driver's license and or your passport? Probably not. Just give them your identifying number. And then you only have that number, name and number. It makes it a lot simpler. Then we take a look. You could do it yourself. You could hire someone like ourselves or someone who is very familiar with this and say, let's do an inventory and analysis. You have these 9 companies. So first, we look at those 9 companies. Are any of them exempt? No, and they fit into the exemptions? Nah, they don't. So now we know they have to be reported. So we have to get that information. Now, sometimes we need to go to get the exact name. We'll need to go to the Secretary of State of where it was formed to get that exact name. Some people, the exact name on the Secretary of State is not the name they've been using in Commerce for years. Mm-hmm. So we got to get the exact name. We have to have EIN number. All right. And if they don't have an EIN number, we got to get an EIN number. And we filed each of those entities with CTA. Then we have to go through the analysis of who the heck is the beneficial owners. So who are the beneficial owners and how do the beneficial owners own their interest? Most cases, it's in a trust. So like I said, trusts themselves are not subject to CTA. So here's a question you get. So you have Brant and wife living revocable trust. And in that living revocable trust, you have your house, which is, a homesteaded exempt entity in Texas. You have a brokerage account, a couple of bank accounts maybe that are in mm-hmm. there. It's not a reporting entity. It's not an entity. Mm-hmm. Now, change that and say, okay, in my living revocable trust, I have my house, which is fine. But I don't have my brokerage account. I have Houston Capital Holdings LLC, a Texas LLC that holds all my brokerage accounts. All right. Now, and my living revocable, that LLC is in my trust where it belongs. Now your trust becomes a reporting entity because it's holding the beneficial interest. I need to know, who are the humans behind everything. If I don't have a human and their house and their driver's license, it's not going to be right. Now, so you got to deal with that. So when you're dealing with older entities, you're researching, if you look at some of the trusts that we create or other attorneys create for your asset protection and for your estate planning, and especially for those of us that have a little bit higher net worth, those trusts can be relatively complicated to accomplish, our clients' goals and objectives. There are different players. There are investment trustees. There are voting trustees. There are family trustees. There are trust protectors. There are investment advisors. There's people holding powers of appointment. There are trusts that are holding other trusts. There are trusts that hold entities that hold other entities. That whole analysis needs to be done to determine who's reporting, who's controlling. Once that's done, all right, you go through that analysis done, and sometimes you have to do some research because this is held by, you got it from, it was held in a trust that your grandfather created, all right? And Now we got to find out who are the controlling people in Grandfather's Trust. And guess what? We don't even have we're a beneficiary. We don't even have a copy of Grandfather's Trust. So now we got to find out if we can get a copy of Grandfather's Trust to see whether or not Grandfather's Trust is reporting, and then try to ask that trustee, who you've never met, you know, for their information, their FinCEN number or their home address and their driver's license. Well, good luck doing that. They're going to tell you to jump off a cliff. Now we're not in compliance. And now we could be the company and the individuals responsible for the company fall into that $500 a day and criminal aspect of that. I think that part may be unconstitutional. But on the other hand, unless we get to who the individuals are, the whole purpose of the act falls apart. Let me get pine on one other thing. This act is horrible. And here's why it's really, really hard. The purpose is noble. But who the burden falling on? All of us, we're not criminals. We're not money launderers. We're not terrorists, right? We're not hiding behind shelf companies. I mean, Biden may have 18 or 19 shelf companies, but we're not hiding behind those. The burden now being placed and the anxiety now being placed on small, but targeted small business owners, not large business owners, small business owners is significant. There's a cost, you know, to get a lawyer to review that so you're in compliance is important. To hire a filing agency, although not expensive, to file it so you don't have to sit there for 2.5-3 hours and try to put 40 entries in to the FinCEN website, a government website, you pull your hair out of your head if we have any left anyway. All right. And then we do all that. And then the question is, after all of that burden on honest, good American working businesses, will this actually stop terrorists, money launderers, and people who have nefarious, I don't think so. They'll find a way around it. It's the old story, like if you take away the guns from all the good people and only the bad people, they don't care about the laws. They get the guns anyway. So it's the same. It's kind of the same governmental mentality. So the hopes are it's unconstitutional. The likelihood, very, very low. So people ask this question. It might be already under the Q&As. So when do I comply? What do I do? What are the next steps? Do I wait? You know, some people will say, well, I'll just form trusts and not use appropriately designed LLCs, corporations, and limited partnerships, which would be hurtful for estate planning and asset protection purposes, which is critically important because we're worried about the multi-million dollar lawsuit that you could lose all your assets. And we're worried about not complying or just complying with the corporate transparent. We got to make sure we keep an appropriate balance and stay focused. You know, kind of keep your eye on the ball along the way with this. So I think that there's a lot of burden and not a tremendous benefit, but the concept is laudable and noble. All right, to help keep people from hiding behind entities. The goal. If I don't know who the humans are, it's not going to be in compliance. But there are many, many exceptions. The other thing, too, is that as all this information is moving back and forth between websites and law firms and clients and where people live and their driver's licenses and perhaps social security numbers, we need to assure ourselves that that private data is encrypted and safe. All right, in all that movement around, and that now there's this great opportunity for people to try to intercept information as it's moving around, and again use that, you know, if that's typical online fraud that's going on. I'm sure there'll be fraudster FinCEN websites, there'll be fraudster filing agencies, there'll be all this stuff to look. What an opportunity to gather your address, your driver's license, your social security number, and use it to the so. Privacy and confidentiality come into question and needs to be set up and needs to be stored. And again, you really need to modify all your existing documents for all of those. So you have 9. So which of those 9? Who are the BOIs? Who are the control? The BOI, because the beneficial ownership interest, will become ultimately obvious along the way. But the control, sometimes in a corporation, you know, What it does, every C-suite, everyone that has enough control needs to report. And then the board that can change the C-suite, they need to report. The owners need to report. Interesting, you can have a scenario I brought up the other day What if you have a LLC, you got 10 members, and they all got 10% ownership interest. Okay. None of them need to report. But whoever manages that needs to report. If the 10 of them, if it's member managed, right? Instead of manager managed, it's member managed. Yep. All 10 yes. members are managers, right?
Yeah.
All 10 now need to report. They didn't need to report as owners. They needed to report as managers. So you got to look at every one of these and kind of figure it out. And that and that's another reason for unconstitutionality. When you create a law that is so burdensome to comply with, we want to comply, but by God, look what we've got to put together a jigsaw puzzle in order to comply. If it's that difficult to comply and there are criminal penalties associated for not complying within a very short time frame, I don't know. You know, I would think that that's just bad law, but it is what it is, and that's what we have right now.
And Brian, so, you got a follow-on question from Lucas.
Just one last point, then we'll take all the questions, and then I'll be done. So, and that is, when do we comply? Some people are going to wait and see what happens before they comply. Other people are early responders and responding right now and getting their FinCEN numbers and complying. My strong suggestion is if you just comply, you know, just get it done early as possible, get it out of the way, put it behind you. If it's declared unconstitutional later, well, hallelujah. You know, the government, believe me, the government knows your social security number. The government knows where you live. It's on, you know, the government knows your gross sales. The, you know, it's on your tax return. Government knows all this, most of this stuff anyway. So comply. Okay, questions.
Okay, question. So on that PEO question we had earlier, it's I'm asking for the operating company, actually, not the PEO. They left PEOs out of the original legislation for PPP funds and ERC and had to come back and clarify. I'm asking for any operating company working with, say, Insperity, for example, where should I, as an operating company, be compliant, but I actually don't own my own employees directly?
Well, again, I would think that even though you don't own the employees directly, I would imagine if you have, this is best guess, because there is no clarification, best guess, if we hired Insperity for 20 of them, those are the 20. If you have less than that, you're not going to work. And the $5 million of gross sales. It's a completely different thing than PPP, which was economics and employee retention tax credits. For that measurement, this is again, really nothing to do with economics. Everything to know. We need to know who owns a company. All right. And I think that if you have, if all of my law firm employees were in a PEO, but they're my employees that the PEO is providing, those that I'm responsible for would count as the 20, is my best opinion, although there's no official opinion on that at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, another question. A public company traded over-the-counter pink sheets. Do shareholders owning greater than 25% need to report?
The answer is no. The public company itself doesn't need to report. If the public company doesn't need to report, then the rest of the requirements are not there. It's exempt.
Okay. So what I'm hearing, though, for my own benefit, I have one LLC, for example, that it was formed a long time ago. So the operating agreement is pretty simple. The members are managers because there's no manager reported. My children are members. They don't have any clue about this. I can guarantee you that.
They have to comply.
Nail
on the head. If your children are members of that LLC and they own, and they're over age 18, and they own over 25%, they need to comply.
Well, if they're less than 25%, if I understood it right,
then they don't need.
But they are managed. It's member managed, so they are members.
So if it's member managed, then the question is do they have enough control? That's a very interesting question. Of course, you solve the problem by just changing that LLC,
sure,
member yeah. managed to manager manager, name you as the manager, problem yep. goes away.
Yeah, but you that should. Means I have so to that, I have to do that though.
Yeah.
And I have to know enough to do that.
Yeah.
Or otherwise they
that's
could
why
be...
that's why we're all here today, Brent. We're all learning, yeah. yes.
Right.
That's something I would do. Other than that, I would say that yeah, if they're all managers, then they all have a potentially enough control that every one of them would require. And there's nothing specific on that yet. It just down okay. to the spirit of the law. We want to know who the heck the owners and controllers are. And in your case, the kids are there. The kid could be God knows what. They want to know who it is. So the answer is, yeah, they got to comply or change it. Just it's a yeah. simple change. Make a sure. manager managed and done.
Yeah.
And then, but if they're even if it's manager managed, if they have less than 25%, then you don't have to report them.
Right. That's it. Made it an easy fix, but it has to be fixed.
Easy fix, but it has to be fixed.
What yeah. I just want to mention one thing is this has come up before, Harry and Brent, and this is an important distinction. So we've had other chairs say, well, you know, most of the companies I'm working with are exempt because of the revenue requirements, employee headcount. But then you get into the detail of the brother sister entities that are carved out from that company that aren't part of the company. It's a separate entity for IP, for stocks, yeah. bond, the cap, whatever. Mm-hmm.
That two ways of dealing with that hopefully everyone gets a great takeaway from, and that is if it's a subsidiary of the exempt company, subsidiary, it's not a reporting entity.
Right.
If it's mm-hmm. if it's a brother sister, in other words, we got another company maybe owned by the same people that is licensing the IP back to OPCO, that IP company is a reporting entity.
Yeah, so I think that's a good point, Paul. I mean, I would agree. Most of my members would be exempt. Their companies would be exempt, but they probably all of them have LLCs for various reasons that are not subsidiaries correct. Of the exempt company.
Correct. So and that's exactly the target of the legislation.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly where they're going. Me too.
Yeah.
Okay, guys. Well, there are no other questions. I really, Brent, it's great to see you again. And Paul, thank you. I hope I left everybody. I think you have it. You understand what's going on now. It's not a complete picture because we don't have a complete picture, but everybody now has enough of the picture as to what to do. We're available to help evaluate. We're available to help file. And we are available to complimentary answer any specific questions that were not asked during this particular webinar.
Well, Harry, I appreciate all of your information and what I'm coming away with. This is a lot more complicated than I realized. And I'm going to be reviewing the recording of this in detail to try to take out of it what I need for myself as well as my members and hopefully sharing it with others that are going to have similar concerns.
Okay. Well, love it, guys. Thank you so much. I'm going off. And
thanks, Harry. Thanks, Brant. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks so much, Paul.
Thank you. Bye-bye. All right.